judges of the United States Court of Appeals in and for the Second Judicial Circuit. Hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Perry versus the First National Bank. Mr. Edelman.
Your Honors, Counsel, and please the Court. There are two issues presented by this appeal. The first is whether the Fair Credit Reporting Act authorizes the First National Bank of Pierre, South Dakota, to access credit report information to target people for what we contend is a scam. The First National Bank offers what purports to be a subprime credit card. The flyer advertising the card offers a credit limit up to $1,500 with a little asterisk after it. If you follow the asterisk, you find that the actual offer is $250 for virtually everyone. That $250 is immediately eaten up by an absurd list of fees not found on normal credit cards. There's a processing fee, an acceptance fee, an annual membership fee, a monthly membership fee. Over the first year, you pay more than the credit limit to get the credit. We contend that this is simply a device that is used to generate default fees that people who subscribe to this immediately find themselves in default. They incur over limit and default fees at the rate of approximately $60 in 1 month, and that this is not a legitimate credit product. It's marketed in a very misleading manner. The first textual paragraph of the flyer says that no security deposit or savings account is required. That statement is literally true, but a classic example of a half-truth. You have to give the bank the money, they just keep it, unlike the case with a card that's secured by a deposit or savings account, where you get a line of credit equal or exceeding the amount of the deposit, and if you handle it properly, you get the money back. Here they just keep it.
Do you have any, I sort of tend to agree with you that this looks like a kind of a phony scam type offer, but are people actually taking advantage of this?
The record
signing up for this thing?
Apparently enough people that the bank offered it, and that this type of offer, which is quite unusual, has attracted the attention of state attorneys general and the Federal Trade Commission. It is not a mainstream credit product, but there are people out there who are desperate enough to fall for this kind of advertising. What we contend in this case, now there's nothing in the record that indicates what happens.
So there's nothing in the record to tell how many people that get this solicitation actually follow through and apply for this card?
The only thing that the record indicates is that it is a minority. The only testimony we were able to allow to get says under 10%. We actually think that it's well under 1% that get this product. There is nothing in the record that indicates that of the people that sign up, how many are actually able to use this as a credit product as opposed to get hit with fees and just find themselves in default immediately. There is nothing which indicates what portion of the bank's income comes from fees, either these an initial list of fees or the later default fees, as opposed to interest for the extension of credit, which is, after all, what the FCRA allows you to intrude into people's credit report information for credit or insurance. There is nothing which indicates any of these things. The district judge held that our proposed complaint did not state a claim, and no discovery was permitted into the subject. Those factual inquiries, I think, are necessary before one can conclude that this is not a legitimate complaint. It is a product which the vast majority of banks do not touch, and which has attracted enforcement attention in the past. In fact, in the early 1990s, the FTC suggested that a credit card with a limit like this raised an issue of fact as to whether it complied under the firm offer of credit exception. And given the inflation, if it raised an issue of fact 10 years ago, it certainly raises an issue of fact now, particularly when coupled with the very questionable advertising that was used.
Mr. Edelman, is it your view that the card offers no value or minimal value?
The card offers value that is so small as not to justify under Cole the intrusion into credit records. Cole expressly requires that the court look into such things as whether the offer is so trivial, so that $1 wouldn't do. Does it have so many conditions that it was not meaningful? Does it have such onerous conditions as to deprive the offer of any appreciable value? That's 389 F3rd at 728 and note 9. It says, look at all of the material conditions that comprise the credit product. Do people actually apply for this credit? Do people complain that it's unintelligible and that they didn't get what they in fact thought was being represented? Those are the inquiries which Cole indicates are pertinent, and we believe that if these inquiries were made in this case, which they were not, that it would show that this is not a legitimate credit product and has either trivial value or no value.
Well, in contrast to Cole, the interest rate is set out, right?
We're not contending that it is not an offer, that it is vague. What we're contending is simply that it's so bad as to be a scam. It's a device to generate default fees from the people that are targeted are not people who have good credit. They're looking for people who have bad credit, in particular recent bankrupts. The advertising is misleading. And
What is the reoccurring? The $6 a month is reoccurring, correct?
That's correct.
And the $50 a year is reoccurring, right?
Annually, that's correct.
Yeah. Are there any others that reoccur? As I understand, there's an acceptance fee, but what are the reoccurring fees?
Those are the only ones in the list. Plus, of course, if you run over the credit limit, you incur over limit and default charges,
yes,
which will recur.
Yeah. I suppose that would be true in any credit card situation, correct?
Yes, except that in most credit card situations, you don't have an initial available credit of $75. You have something that people can actually use to get a hotel room. You couldn't even charge a tank of gas for this. We contend that this doesn't qualify for the intrusion into credit report information. I think it, at the minimum, creates an issue of fact, and that district court should have held that we stated a claim and that factual inquiry was required. The other issue we present is, was the private right of action for disclosure violations in 1681M abrogated by FACTA, the Fair and Accurate Credit Transactions Act? The Northern District judges that passed in this all held that the defendant was right and there is no more private right of action. The Eastern District of Virginia came to the contrary conclusion, agreeing with us. The one thing that is clear is that the statute contains serious drafting errors. There is no reading of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, as amended by FACTA, which gives effect to every provision that Congress put in there and makes any sense. If I am correct, then Congress used the word subsection in a couple of places in 1681MH, used the word section where subsection would be the appropriate word. If the defendant and the court below is correct, you have the following errors. You have two fairly large paragraphs which do absolutely nothing. 1681 MH7 and 1681 S-2 are totally duplicative and do nothing. You have Congress stating in 312F of fact, a provision which is not codified, that nothing in this section, the amendments made by this section, or any other provision of this act, FACTA, shall be construed to affect any liability that existed on the day before the date of enactment. And then you have the supposedly plain language of 1681MH8 taking away what the prior section gave. You have 1681MH8 in the wrong place, a provision intended to apply to an entire section, such as 1681M, is supposed to be designated a subsection. The next available subsection designation would be 1681MI. On the other hand, a provision intended to apply to just a subsection would be designated as a paragraph, which was
Mr.
not here.
Even let's assume that there's both surpluses and perhaps ambiguity. Doesn't it seem clear, though, that under 1681MH8, that Congress clearly intended to preempt the cause of action, the private cause of action? I mean, accepting your structural criticisms.
Congress intended to remove a private right of action, but for what? The legislative history and 312F state that what was intended was that the new sections that were being added were not to have a private right of action until the bugs were worked out. But expressly, existing liabilities were not affected. I should point out that there is nothing clear or plain about the word section. It's been used in dictionaries and by the Supreme Court to refer to any subdivision of a statute. In an effort to impose order and avoid this problem, certain drafting manuals were issued which indicate that section would mean what is here 1681M, subsection 1681MH, and so forth. But what is absolutely clear is that those manuals were not followed because none of the other problems which I advert to are authorized by those manuals or any other provision, that governs statutory construction.
Mr. Edelman, you may continue, but
I will save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Edelman. Mr. Duff.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Kevin Duff on behalf of Defendant Appley First National Bank. Your Honor, the issues that have been placed before the Court with respect to both the firm offer of credit and the private right of action issue, I think that I'll take them in the order that counsel did. Specifically, if we would talk about the issue of the firm offer of credit under 1681.
On that one, who in their right mind would ever agree to accept these terms?
Your Honor, if you look at the value of this offer, we'd identify several things that come right at the face of the offer. First of all, counsel drew a juxtaposition of the amount of fees relative to the amount of credit, but he talked about fees over an annual basis. He talked about the credit over an annual basis. The point is that if you use this credit card...
If I get this in the mail, it gives me a $250 credit limit, which isn't enough to buy the new Ping driver I just bought last week. I owe you $175 the minute I say yes to this card, don't I?
That is the amount of initial fees. That's correct, Your Honor.
So without buying a thing, I owe you $175 the minute I get this card.
But you get the card, and you get the power of the card. You get an internationally recognized Visa. You get the ability to use that in innumerable establishments. You get up to in the first year alone, if you pay off your credit limit, your credit, your balance on a monthly basis, you're going to have up to $3,000 in credit available to you. So while you may use the example of a Ping driver, somebody who actually this card was targeted to, was offered to, would be able to use this to gain access to the Internet, something you cannot do without a credit card. You can't buy things with cash on the Internet, but you have that ability with a credit card. You have the ability to build credit. If you have a stressed credit history, you need to start somewhere. This card provides that opportunity. You can build credit. This is, and it, you can't build that credit if you don't have You can't build your credit history or your credit rating or improve it if you don't have credit that you're using. And this card provides that opportunity. It also allows the opportunity, as I said, to be used at innumerable establishments. For instance, this card could be used to buy groceries. It could be used to buy lunches. It could be used
with a $250 limit. I mean, I don't know. I think most people have credit cards run up significantly more than that every month on a credit card.
Your Honor, this might not be the credit card that you or I have in our pockets, but this is what we need to look
thank
at.
Thank God. I'm glad I don't have this card.
But we need to look at this in terms of who this credit card was offered to.
We don't know what his credit rating is, so maybe he does want the card.
Well, it's a possibility. It's a possibility.
I would need a lot of these cards.
But I think we need to look at this in the context of who this offer was made to. And what this court has said previously in the Murray decision is the test that the court here needs to evaluate, and I'm looking at 434F3rd 955, it says that the test is that you need to separate the use of credit data to sell products, which is forbidden, from the use of credit data to make firm offers of credit, which is allowed. And the court specifically held, describing what it had done previously in the Cole versus U.S. Capital case, is saying a court must determine whether the offer has value as an extension of credit alone. That's what you need to look at. And the issue here is, was this an offer of credit? If we contrast this case to the circumstances in Cole, for instance, in Cole versus U.S. Capital, the court's concern there was that the credit that was offered was really just an opportunity to come to an auto dealership and buy a car, and that the amount of credit that was offered in that circumstance was not even near enough to buy the product that it was tied to. Here, that's not true at all. There's no tie-in of any product here. The credit card alone can be accepted, and then the credit that's available can be used.
Mr.
And it can
Duff,
be used.
If you apply for the card, pay the fees, and don't use it, would it still be a gateway to that $3,000 second year availability? As I understand you, after a year of appropriate or credit-worthy use of the card, you can then qualify, you establish a history, if you will, a non-stress history. That's an interesting word. I have to remember that you have bad credit, you have stress credit, right? Is that an industry term, by the way?
I think it's used occasionally.
My stress is normally dealing with colleagues, not with credit. But in any event, would that trigger it? In other words, if you made the investment, so to speak, in this card, could you then move into the better rank of credit worthiness?
You're going to increase your credit by using the card. You have to use. In other words, if you look at, we made reference to what the Fair Isaacs company has said you need to do to improve your credit. If you use the card, you use the available credit, and you make responsible payments, that's how you'll increase your credit card. If you get the card, that's a benefit. Having the card is better than not having a card. That would be a contrast, for instance, to the secured credit issue that counsel issued, where oftentimes that doesn't even hit the credit report. Here you have an unsecured credit card, which will help your credit history.
So if someone with a bad credit history wanted to have the card to protect against or the need for a bond on a driving violation, but didn't use it during the year, in other words, wanted to have that rather than AAA or something, that wouldn't trigger the better credit. You actually, I mean, it paid the $6 a month and the acceptance fee. You actually have to use it, don't you, to get into the $3,000 credit line?
Typically, that's true, unless there's some other way that you're improving your credit. But having the credit alone, the credit card alone has its
benefits. So you need to do the $250 a month at least, and that credit line, and pay it regularly, and then you automatically qualify, or do you have to reapply for the?
No,
the
$3,000.
That's based on 12 times $250 a month.
Correct. That means that in the first year alone, you could use up to $3,000 in credit. You could actually use more.
At 250 intervals.
Correct, Your Honor. That's
right. So you don't automatically get a credit limit of $3,000 here.
No, that's correct. That's correct,
okay.
Your Honor. In other words, each month, and that, just using a year as an example, you could use the card for $250 a month. You could actually use it for more than $250 a month if you chose to pay off the balance more regularly. So, for instance, if you were very proactive and you sent in a check halfway through the month, as soon as your check hits the gets to the bank, you clear your balance, you've got $250 available right then and there. So that's true when in, on a recurring basis. The point of the what the Seventh Circuit has said previously in both the Cole versus U.S. Capital case and Murray versus GMAC is that you need to distinguish this from a credit product versus a sales pitch. In this instance, this is a credit product. That's what you need to evaluate for making the determination there. I'd like to turn to address some of the arguments that were made with respect to the 1681M issue. Counsel had made the issue that, and pointed out himself, that the issue with respect to the amendment which added 1681MH was that the section should have meant subsection. He said this was a drafting error. But what the United States Supreme Court has said in Lemie versus U.S., this is 540 U.S. at 542, that if there is a drafting error, that is up for Congress to change. It's not the province of this court to change the drafting errors of a statute. But really, that's not the point. If we look at this issue on its face, when the court is evaluating what the word section means in section 1681MH8, the court has to first start with the plain language of the statute. It's beyond cavil that the United Supreme Court has said repeatedly, that's where you start. And here, section doesn't say subsection. Section says section. And if you look at the language itself, as a perfect example of that is looking at 1681MH8B, which is the administrative enforcement section. If you look at the reference, the word section is used three times in that sentence. The first time it says this section, the question is what does this section refer to? At least that's the question posed by the appellant. And then there's a reference to section 1681S, and then at the end of the sentence to that section. The use of the word that section can only refer to section 1681S. And if you understand the word section to be used in that way, then the reference to this section in 8AB can only refer to section 1681M in its entirety. And that is what the plain language says. There is no ambiguity there. Yes, it's true that the amendment could create some redundancy, could create some superfluous language. But the Supreme Court has also said, again in the Lemie decision, that superfluous language or redundant language is never should never lay waste to the plain language of a statute. And the plain language plus surplusage is preferred over non-surplusage and ambiguity.
That you got through that sentence that well.
Thank you very much.
It's a compliment. It's hard to even read it, but you did a great job, Mr. Duff.
It was close. Thank you. Now, to address the Barnett opinion, which was just brought to the court's attention by the plaintiff appellant last week, that is a one-of-a-kind decision. It is contrary to what this court has said in Murray versus GMAC, where the Seventh Circuit noted that that FACTA had abolished the private right of action under 1681M. It's also contrary to at least 12 district court judges in this circuit, in more than 16 opinions, have reached a contrary conclusion. But the Barnett opinion is also wrong, because the language that the Barnett opinion was focused on was a standard retroactivity provision. If you look more closely at what that provision provides, it talks about no change to any liability that existed on the day before the enactment of this act. Moreover, the focus of the language in Section 312F related to liability. There's nothing, no reference at all to remedies that are available. All that said was if you had liability before the amendment, you continue to have it, but after the amendment, that's changed. Unless the court has any other questions?
Apparently not. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Edelman?
Your Honor, counsel's entire discussion of whether this is a firm offer of credit emphasizes why there are issues of fact. There is nothing in the record which indicates that people pay $250 off at the end of the first month. On the contrary, if they had the $250 and had any common sense, they would get a secured credit card, which would enable them to have the same amount of credit and get the money back rather than pay it to the bank outright. In any event, this is all an issue of fact. There is no indication that anybody actually uses this to build credit, and if in fact you immediately incur default charges because you try to charge a golf club or a tank of gas on a credit card with a $75 limit, then you're not going to be better off. You're going to be much worse off. Murray does not abrogate the statement the court's holding in Cole that a $1 or other nominal amount of credit, even if nominally a credit product, authorizes an intrusion into credit report information. It no more allows the accessing of credit report information to find victims than to sell products. Only bona fide extensions of credit are authorized, and whether this is such is a question of fact. With respect to 1681M, the Murray decision, which I alluded to, did not involve briefing of this issue. There, all the conduct took place before the alleged repeal. Therefore, the effect of the subsequent amendment, which took effect 12-104, was not really at issue. The Lemie case, the Supreme Court case referred to, involved a case where it was entirely unclear whether there was a drafting error. The question is whether the words attorney and professional person in a section of the bankruptcy code represented alliteration in the sense of devise and bequeath or a drafting error. On the other hand, where a drafting error is clear, and I think counsel admitted that you can't make sense of this statute and give effect to all its provisions as written, the court has not hesitated to act. For example, the Turcotte case, where this court and many others essentially rewrote the Controlled Substances Analog Act to insert the words, a controlled substance analog exists if you meet Clause A plus either Clause B or Clause C. The relationship between the clauses being totally unclear from the statute. Congress never bothered amending it. I looked at it this morning, and it still is in the same condition it was when this court had to act. And the court did what was necessary when it was clear that an error had been committed. There is no plain language here. Section does not have any intrinsic meaning. And most importantly, at no time has either the court below, any other district judge that agreed with the court below, or counsel for the defendant suggested what Congress was doing when it inserted not less than two totally redundant provisions, put 1681 MH8 in the wrong place. You have six subdivisions dealing with risk-based pricing notice, and then supposedly they jump over and have two that affect the entire statute. Nothing. No plausible explanation has ever been advanced. On the other hand, we go through the legislative, the drafting history, and show how it is entirely possible that subsection and section were interchanged when the statute was literally cut and pasted overnight. It's a very simple error, and I think that the correction is also simple. Unless your honors have some questions, my time is up.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Edelman. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.